Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the Media Podcast. I'm Matt Deegan. On the show today, less show, more repeats. That's the future of the BBC, according to the National Audit Office. We'll unpack what that means for programme makers and audiences. Meanwhile, The Guardian's hit 1 million paid subscribers, all without a paywall. So what can other publishers learn from this milestone? Plus, we look back at the scoops of the year, as judged by the British Journalism Awards, ponder Lad Bible's rise and rise, and in the media quiz, we find out who's to blame. That's all coming up in this edition of the Media Podcast. And joining me today, making her Media Podcast debut, is journalist, writer and comedian Suchanchika Chakrabarty. Welcome to the show. You sort of kicked off with a podcast around Black Mirror. Were you tempted to start one on Succession?
Oh, a bit, yeah. I managed to bring in talk about Succession into another podcast I do called But Is It Funny, which is about comedy criticism. So is Succession a comedy, I think, is a big question.
And was there much Succession chat at the British Journalism Awards this week?
Actually, I think a lot of the conversation was around, oh, it's so nice to be here in person, because the year before was the first time I judged it last year, and it was a virtual ceremony, so it was really nice to be back in the ballroom at the Hilton Bankside, and yeah, it's just lovely to see people. But obviously this was just before we sort of got this panic again about the Omicron numbers, so it's a blissful time.
You haven't been pinged yet then?
No, so I must have done all right at the awards.
And also making their debut, it's the founder of the week, John Connell. John, I'll be dining out on that forever, but you're a serial entrepreneur, so I can't imagine you've been resting on your laurels. What are you working on at the moment?
Well, we have a habit in life of doing the same thing all over and over again. I'm doing something which is different to the week, although it has the same kind of general idea behind it. I mean, the week, after all, I conceived more than 25 years ago, and I felt there was room for a daily newsletter, which goes out, you know, a short daily newsletter, 5 minutes a day, just bringing you the most interesting ideas, the most fun quotes, the best little stories from the day. And that's what I'm doing. And we've been going for a few months and it's doing quite well.
And that's called The Knowledge?
It's called The Knowledge, yeah.
And where can people subscribe to that if they want to get it in their inbox?
Go to our website, the Knowledge website, and you sign up. And at the moment, it's completely free. So it has, and I suppose one thing we try to do is against the sort of general doom and gloom, which it infiltrates the media everywhere. And I suppose I did this up to a point in the week. So I try also to find slightly more positive, without being Pollyanna-ish about it, slightly more positive stories. So that's what we do. We try to reflect the most interesting comment around the world, but also to bring you some of the more fun stuff that's going on.
And also joining us is the Times media correspondent, Jake Kantar. Congratulations, Jake, on moving to the paper of record. And thanks for still answering our calls. Looking back at the last year, what do you reckon the biggest story you've had to cover is?
That's a good question. I was going to say that I'm not a newcomer. I feel like the hackneyed veteran on this podcast. what's the biggest news story of the last year? That is extraordinary. I think one of the big stories, which we might touch on later, was the amazing scoop in The Guardian from the reporting that carried on over a series of stories about Noel Clarke, which sparked a whole Me Too movement in the television industry, which is kind of still going on now. I think we will see the results of that next year when a review completes into whether processes are good enough for people to raise historical complaints.
We'll pick on that a bit later when we talk about some of the British Journalism Awards. But another big story that you've been covering is the National Audit Office's report on the BBC, which was released on Friday morning. I suppose we should start with you, Jake. You know, what were the key findings?
Yes, yeah, so the National Audit Office has done what is essentially a pretty comprehensive review of the BBC's savings initiatives. And although it's not extremely critical of the BBC, it makes very ugly reading. And that is because the BBC's finances are in the middle of increasing turbulence, and the BBC has to find more and more savings. It has already saved close to £1 billion over the last 5 to 6 years. And the BBC forecasts that it's going to have to save exactly the same amount over the next 5 to 6 years again. And that is a best case scenario for the BBC, depending on the outcome of the licence fee settlement, which we're expecting early next year and could put another dent in its finances, which means it has to make further savings. Now, talking about savings can be quite abstract. I think the thing that matters here and the thing that comes through clearly in this report is the BBC has made the easy savings. All the back office, behind the scenes stuff that we don't see as audiences, the majority of that work has been done. The majority of those savings have been sort of wrung out of the corporation. Now is the time when we are going to see a greater impact on the audience facing services that the BBC has. And one way that that will manifest itself is through more repeats. We've seen an increase in repeats across the BBC over the last few years. And the projection is that that's only going to increase as the BBC sort of focuses its financing on prime time.
In the chair of the Public Accounts Committee, Meg Hillier, she sort of said the BBC should be worried about its kind of battle for viewers now it's starting cutting money from what we see on the screen. I mean, the BBC are always in a terrible position with this. You know, one, they're told to make cuts. Two, that their money's cut back anyway. They got probably less than inflationary increases with the new settlement. So real income will be in decline. I mean, what can they do? They're damned if they do and they're damned if they don't, aren't they?
It's a very difficult predicament for the BBC. I mean, look, the new settlement that we'll hear about next year, it's very unlikely that the BBC is going to get an increase in its funding. The more likely scenario is we'll get real terms cuts. And at the same time as that kind of domestic story, we've got this global story going on for the BBC where it is becoming a minnow, increasingly a minnow, in the face of competition from the likes of Netflix, Amazon, Apple. And all of those players are not only competing for eyeballs, they're also driving up the cost of making content. Which is kind of like this dual-pronged pincer movement attack on the BBC. Equally, the BBC is contending with people refusing to pay the licence fee. We've got an increased number of licence fee refuseniks, about 700,000, according to the last annual report. And that is only going to go up if people are thinking that they are being served up a diet of repeats.
And also they've started doing more co-productions with people like Netflix, but that's going to have a knock-on effect to the money they get back from IP rights or third-party sales rights, isn't it, around the world. So save some money early on, but not so great for future income.
Yeah, we've seen a huge increase in co-productions, as the industry calls it. I think about 84 to 86% of... there's been an 84 to 86% increase over the last few years in the number of co-productions the BBC's doing. So that's the BBC working with the likes of Netflix to fund drama, other shows. So a good example of that is something like Bodyguard, which was co-funded by Netflix. So was Dracula. That's been a crutch for the BBC. It has allowed it to invest more in big budget drama. But as you say, it could come back to bite them later on because they will be bringing in less revenue from intellectual property.
Suchandrika, if you look at the BBC News, the BBC News division, they've sort of stalled over some of their savings. I think they were sort of let off a bit over the coronavirus. They've got another £90 million to save. They cut things like the Andrew Neil show. They've reduced Newsnight's budget. Where more can they target these cuts, do you think?
Oh, it's a horrible idea, isn't it? The thing is, things like investigations, which cost money, are also things that build trust. So when you start cutting those expensive projects, which are long term, which cost money over time, which can go beyond their budgets quite easily, you are kind of playing with your reputation. And that's the last thing the BBC wants to do, is to lose the reputation that they have, which is incredible and global. So that's not ideal, but it does tend to be true of newspapers that that's what's cut first. Look at investigations. Where can we trim something off? They're probably going to be looking at the salaries of their biggest stars, aren't they? And then we've already got places like GB News, which we're going to mention later. We've got other broadcast services that will be very happy to pay them more. And it seems like that'll be what will happen in the future, that people are kind of looking around. The BBC can only pay me so much, or they're asking me to live on less. Why would I necessarily want to do that? Maybe I'll look elsewhere, because the competition isn't just for the audience, is it? The competition is also for the people who make the news, who make the shows, who front them. And if they're well known, they can take their audience elsewhere. So that could be the danger, I think.
John, when we look at this, we've got these news changes, we've got kind of issues around drama, repeats. Is there a big danger for the BBC with all these cuts?
Well, there is, but there's, as you've said, there would be great resistance to raising the licence fee, and there's increasing concern about numbers of people who won't pay it. So I think that's a dodgy course to try and do that. And I mean, I suppose the BBC's just got to concentrate on the things that it's known for, the things it's best at. And I rather agree that investigations are important, panorama-style programmes. And it's really news where the BBC scores most. I think it's going to have to be careful about new drama, occasional new drama in areas which are rather upmarket and which are not really probably so much competition from Netflix, etc. But I don't personally think that having quite a lot of repeats in non-prime time is a bad thing. It's more important for the BBC to focus its resources on the things it does really well. And I still think it probably tries to do too much, too many radio stations. I mean, what we really love about the BBC are BBC One and BBC Two, but also the World Service. And personally, again, I would like to see them back doing more sport. I mean, the only major sport event now, I think I'm right in saying they do, is the Wimbledon final.
Jake, do you think this is exactly where the government wants the BBC? You know, it's sort of rounds and rounds of cuts, now having to really cut into programming things that people love. One of the Conservatives' issues is often with how popular the BBC is with the public. This is what they've always been after, isn't it?
Well, we often get sort of double talk with ministers. They talk about the BBC being a beacon of excellence and of Britishness around the world. But at the same time, you know, when they're not necessarily on the record, they're briefing against the BBC, or their political aides are scything the BBC down with their quotes. You know, like, I think the government clearly is minded to reduce the BBC's funding in some way. But the noises that we are getting is that we don't expect the BBC to be punished, really punished, in a way that perhaps the mood music was sounding even a year ago, before Boris Johnson had hit the pandemic and was riding high. He felt emboldened to bully the BBC. We think that has toned down a bit, but you know, the BBC is still a target. It's still an easy target. We've seen Nadine Dorries questioning the impartiality of individual journalists such as Andrew Marr. The BBC is not brilliant at fighting back, and therefore, you know, it's an easy political point scoring mechanism for ministers to use.
And looking at another news provider, this time The Guardian, they announced they've got over 1 million paying subscribers, half of which are outside the UK, they said. So I guess, where does this put them in terms of other top news providers? Suchandrika, what do you think, how do you think they rate amongst the others?
Well, they've overtaken The Economist and The Financial Times, which is a really big deal, actually. So The Economist had about 964,000 and the FT 987,000 the last time they counted. And these are from June 2021. So they probably have got over that million now, but they didn't make the big announcement The Guardian made. That is huge to get past those two publications. But I will say The Guardian's probably more generalist. And so on the one hand, that's helpful because it can appeal to a broad range of people. But on the other hand, the FT and The Economist have quite a wealthy audience, and an audience, you know, it's companies, it's people in business who... they're very motivated to keep those subscriptions going. So on the one hand, Guardian's had a bit of a bigger job. Like every time you read an article, it pops up, a bit like Wikipedia, and says, hey, you've read however many articles, would you consider doing X, Y, Z? And also they got a nice tone when they sort of like pitched it correctly, but it's difficult doing it person by person. But it's clearly worked out. And I think part of the reason is they expanded into the US and Australia in 2011 and 2013, as they've built up authority over a decade, which has clearly done well for them.
John, what's really impressive is they've done all this whilst they haven't instigated a paywall. How do you think they've managed to coax 1 million people to pay up?
I think it's amazing that they've done that. I mean, begging works is one way of putting it. They don't tell you you have to pay. They ask you to pay. And in the end, you get perhaps shamed into paying. And I think it's rather a clever. I think you're right that it's sort of the way that their approach is rather friendly and nice. I've always thought the Guardian news coverage is really good, almost as good as the Telegraph's. But, you know, if you take not everyone, it's not everyone's politics, but a lot of people love the way they do news. It's very easily accessible. And I think the way they tackle that is clever. Just constantly asking. I mean, Substack, Andrew Sullivan, who I follow on Substack, does something rather similar, which is he says, if you want to subscribe to me, you can pay $50 a year or $1 a week or nothing. And, you know, most of us feel, well, if we're going to enjoy this, this guy's got a living to make, and we feel a bit the same about The Guardian.
Do you think it says something about their audience as well?
Yes. And I think it may be, you know, particularly in the kind of age where they went through sort of Trump and all the feeling of, you know, The Guardian was sort of fighting a battle against all that kind of stuff. People want to support them. Yeah. So I do think it says something about their audience. In a way, it's a surprising thing because they're not the FT or The Economist audience. And yet there they are, happy to cough up. It's rather encouraging for the likes of me.
Jake, what do you make of what the editor, Kath Vine, has been doing with the paper and the website since she took over? What about 5 years ago now?
Well, I mean, it's kind of remarkable that they've managed to entice this number of subscribers when it's given it's not particularly clear what the benefits of subscribing are. I mean, you get, exactly. you get ad-free content and you get, you know, more crosswords. It's probably not one for me, I have to say. So it's really impressive. I agree with John completely. It goes back to what John said. It's fantastic journalism. It's you know, clearly, the Guardian occupies a reasonably unique place in our broadsheet landscape here in the UK, that is something that works to its advantage. I think this also shows that there's a third way. It doesn't have to be all advertising or like the Times, which is entirely behind a paywall. And that's really encouraging for the future of journalism.
And what do you think about what Kath's done to the product?
I'm not a Guardian reader all the time anyway.
I'll let you off, Jake. John?
Well, I read it a bit and I like it. I think she's, you know, modern and fun. I mean, this is just me very personally, but I feel the range of comment is a little narrower than it used to be. I feel there were more voices perhaps back during Alan Rusbridge's day, but that's just my own reaction. I'm still pleased to see Simon Jenkins in there, however. But I read it mainly for the news and the sort of G2 stuff rather than for the comment.
What about Adrian Charles with his boring columns?
He's an internet phenomenon.
Yes, well, then maybe that's the answers of the Kath Bider question.
That is the only answer.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move to the British Journalism Awards. Suchanchika, as we said, you were there as a judge. Can you run us down the biggest scoops?
Yes. So I was one of the judges on the arts and entertainment journalism side. So what the British Journalism Awards sort of wants to do and asks us as judges to do is looking at journalistic skill and rigour. Is it revelatory, so bringing new information to light, and does it serve the public interest? So it's really that kind of journalism, your sort of classic principles. And so I was looking at arts and entertainment journalism, which is not classically where you necessarily get sort of big investigations, big revelatory stuff. But this year, you know, one thing did really stand out, and that was Ciarán Cale, Lucy Osborne, looking into the actor-director Noel Clarke, loads of allegations against him, women been mistreated. And really what that's done is change the conversation around how these things are working in the TV industry. It's a kind of really unregulated industry in terms of, like, there are late nights, people go on location. It's kind of very blurred lines in that sense of you've got to work very physically closely with people. And so there's kind of ample space for things to happen. But at the same time, because you don't have classic career paths, you don't have job security, most people are freelancers, people are very afraid to speak up and to say, this powerful person did something, I'm very uncomfortable, I feel like, you know, whatever they felt, you know, something very negative happened and I'm going to speak up. Very few people feel brave enough, and very few people felt they'd be believed. So to take this investigation and write a string of stories around it, I think one of the best things come out of it is, apart from exposing what's happened, is the fact that many, many more people have come to them with allegations, and there are more stories in the offing. And it's about the sources feeling safe and feeling like they're not putting their livelihoods on the line in order to say something, and to not have that guilt of, well, I should have said something because it's happened to someone else, but if I did say something, there goes my life. They shouldn't have to make that choice. So for me, and I think all the other judges, you know, that it was such a clear winner in that sense, and it was such a big breakthrough. And there were loads of other great entries in the arts and entertainment in the category, but for me, this was kind of far and away just really fitting that kind of public interest journalism. It's great to see two women in charge of investigation. That doesn't happen often enough in British newspapers. And again, it's The Guardian doing an investigation really well, something that is very interesting to people and something that broke new ground. And they did say in The Guardian's sort of little article on how they've broken a million paying readers, they did mention the sort of Pegasus investigation. All of these investigations add to the sense of people going, well, I'm going to go back and read them, I trust them, and I will pay them to do more of this stuff. So it really does help in terms of them getting new subscribers and sort of burnishing their reputation.
It does definitely provide real value, doesn't it? You know, it's unique stories that you can't just pick up on, you know, on rewrites on other sources. Also, it had an effect, didn't it? You know, it put BAFTA on the back foot quite significantly, and they had to really rethink how, you know, their initial announcements were pretty like hands off. Hey, it's an award, we don't see any of this stuff. But they had to really engage with it afterwards, didn't they?
Yeah, there's been this kind of problem in the comedy world that there's no human resources. Like, everyone's a freelancer, and there's no one kind of in charge. And who do you make your complaints to, and who actually enforces the solutions? And I think, yeah, BAFTA can say we just give out awards, but actually they're in a position of power. They've given Noel Clarke positions of power, and it's put him in positions of power over other women, younger women, women who are new to the industry, and allowed certain things to happen. So it's not BAFTA's fault, obviously, but at the same time, they have to understand that who they decide is in the right or wrong, or who they support, or who they put on their panels and put in front of podiums at their awards, that tells us something about who they believe in and who they think is right. And so, yes, to begin with, BAFTA didn't want to climb down. They didn't want to change their point of view, but they did eventually. So the investigation sort of took on this committee and said, well, actually, you represent the best of TV and film in the UK. Are you not going to do something? And they're like, actually, yes, we will. And so that, again, that's a huge breakthrough.
I mean, it was a remarkable investigation. I read it and I just thought, this is masterful in the way that they've sourced it and told the story so coherently. Absolutely brilliant. I was entirely and incredibly jealous when I read it, because I just thought I would love to have been involved in a piece of work like
that. That's almost the sign of a good scoop, isn't it? When you just think, God, that's the one that I would have really liked.
Yes. You know, it has made change in the industry. BAFTA dealt with subsequent allegations about a producer called Charlie Hanson, who has worked closely with Ricky Gervais in the past on shows like Afterlife. Later allegations emerged about him, and BAFTA was rapid in suspending Charlie as a member So it has shaped the way the industry thinks about these things. The other things on the list that caught my eye, I mean, my glib comment about the Guardian to one side, I thought Marina Hyde was a very, very worthy winner of the comment award. Sophia Smith-Gaylor as well, who has done pretty remarkable work on TikTok and showed how potent TikTok can be as a platform for journalists in terms of engaging new audiences and explaining things in an entirely new way to audiences. I think she's done brilliant work on that front.
John, it's easy to think that things are looking really rosy in journalism when you obviously see the best of journalism in one night. I mean, you're across this every day now with the knowledge. Do you think journalism is in good shape?
In many ways, I think it is. I just wanted to echo quickly that I think Marina Hyde is very deserving of an award. I think partly because she brings humour into things. I mean, as Michael Deacon does on The Telegraph, and I think it's quite a rare commodity in British papers, and it's one to be celebrated. And I think she's genuinely funny and makes her points in a witty way. But no, I think that, you know, there's all this talk about newspapers being on the way out and so forth, but there are so many now ways that journalists can get through, not just through newspapers, but through podcasts like this and through blogs and so on. And I think that actually the diversity of opinion, you know, it's amazing really how much stuff. I mean, we're always struggling for choice on the knowledge where we're trying to pick out surprising and interesting views every day. And there's a lot of competition from it, and not just from here, but right around the world. You know, we're often running comments from Africa or Australia, and I think it's rather sort of a boom time for journalism.
And we'll be back with more diversity of opinion after this.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Welcome back. Suchandra Kerr, John and Jake are still with me, and it's time for some media news in brief. Lad Bible, the British social media platform, has been valued at around 200 million quid after floating on the stock market this week. Its owner, Alexander Solomou, pocketed 50 million in the process. John, that's not too shabby. What is his secret, do you think?
I think it's a very clever little formula. And I mean, it's not really what you'd expect, which is a sort of celebration of old-fashioned masculinity or whatever. They've just found a niche, and they seem... I suppose it's really, they appeal hugely to students. Again, I mean, you know, I'm sure Sukhendrita and Jake will know more than I do. But I mean, it seems to me that they do it with humour and they're quite funny and they're always coming up with very shareable stuff. And I think that's important so that, you know, it's all that sort of memes and stuff that you can share. It's not, I don't think you could say aimed at me, but I think they've done a wonderful job. And again, I think one of the lessons of this is that the future of media is more and more going to be in niche. and people who identify a niche and then really go to it know how to create the character of what they're doing and appeal to a particular audience. And I think it does that brilliantly.
I mean, it's not something that I sort of follow, but it's definitely something that cuts through and you see on other platforms or see referenced a lot. Suchanjika, it's barely recognisable compared to how it started, though, back in 2012, where it was a little more maybe misogynistic. Do you think it's broken through and away from its beginnings?
So, yeah, apparently they knew that this was a problem and there was a real effort to change what the lad meant in Lad Bible. So it's been changed to mean a caring individual who looks after the friend's mental health and worries about plastic waste, which is so specific. I love it. I want to know more about this individual. What do they think about dolphins? Just so many things. But what I think is really important is that it started on a Facebook page. And if anyone sort of, maybe Jake has a bit, has dealt with like social media teams on a newspaper particularly, they have got their stats down to an art form. So I did some work on the social media team over at the Mirror when I was there, and they've got reports upon reports upon reports. Like, you think generally the social audience person will have all the websites kind of traffic, but the social media team have everything because they're doing like customer services, because stuff is coming in as well as putting stories out. They've got stats beyond belief. And so they know exactly what works, what's getting engagement, videos doing well. Remember the whole pivot to video in about 2015 and then the pivot to redundancy, I think. I don't know what happened there. But your social media team have got the goods. And so to start from a social media platform, you kind of, you work out your engagement strategies really quickly. And then there was just another piece I found about them from November this year on The Drum, and basically the Lad Bible team took the whole day off to play PlayStation 5. Now, I don't know if that's a dream for you guys. I couldn't tell a PlayStation 5 from a Game Boy, so it'd be lost on me. But basically they sort of said they had a sort of they're doing a bit of an advertorial thing, I think, with PlayStation. They said, right, let's take the day off and let's play PlayStation 5 and show our audience, you know, what it's like. And I think they're positioning themselves as pretty much the same as their reader. And again, you've got to have a really strong niche to do that. But it's very satisfying to see people just like yourself sort of road testing an item you might want to buy to show you what a day in the life of is like. And to have the time and the money and space to do that is pretty incredible. So I think they are... they're sort of doing a lot of work for the potential reader already by saying, look, we're the same, you and I, let's go and do this together. And it means you're not searching around going, are they for me? You're going either yes, they're for me, or no. And the fact is, they said they're getting, their content reaches 2/3 of 18 to 34 year olds in the UK monthly, and they get 750,000 comments a day on Facebook alone. And now Facebook is losing eyeballs because of its many problems and because it's kind of seen as an older generational thing. So to still be doing that in 2021 means that they are reviewing their strategies for engagement constantly because of their data, and they're doing it well.
Jake, are they closer to their audience than some established media is, perhaps?
I think, I mean, it's clear that they have a very good idea of who their audience is and they serve that audience well. It's a really, you know, it's a real British success story, Lad Bible. It might not be fashionable or popular among the chattering classes, but... you know, these figures Alexander Solomou's earnings are testament to that. And what we've just discussed is spot on. I mean, whereas traditional publishers have tried to adapt to the social world, this is kind of a publisher that has grown out of the social world. And let's not forget that a lot of big tech companies have slightly questionable beginnings. If you look at Facebook, that was FaceMash initially. And then, you know, I seem to remember Snapchat was popular because of certain anatomical pictures. That's how that started. I think one of the things that is really interesting is that the Lad Bible is now a way that politicians... try to reach out to different audiences. So we've seen them do interviews with the likes of Rishi Sunak, and it's gone the other way as well. I know the former head of comms at Lad Bible, a guy called Peter Hennigan, used to work at BuzzFeed as well, but he now works at Downing Street. So these things are cross-pollinating.
And finally, just before the media quiz, the section that is sort of rapidly becoming known as GB News News, as there's some developments each episode. This time, Simon McCoy, erstwhile of the BBC, has left his show, or is about to, and has been replaced by Eamon Holmes, who's reunited with his Sky News partner, Isabel Webster. John, you're no stranger to launching things. What have you made of GB News launch and first few months?
Well, the launch was chaotic, and I can't say I watch it very much. I think it's very, very hard doing this kind of stuff, especially when you have to have a huge budget, which you do for TV, and when you've got so much competition. I think having the loss of Andrew Neil, I don't think it's ever really recovered from. Now, I don't know the numbers, but I think the danger is if you've got, and you've lost another one now, a mainstream media person like Andrew leaving... immediately, you know, someone like me, I might watch it if Andrew Neil's there because I don't see him on the BBC and I think he's a brilliant interviewer. There aren't any better. And he really knows how to question a politician in a way that most political journalists are not as good at as him. But now that he's there, it's very hard for one to give many reasons as to why you'd want to watch GB News. I mean, I can see that it's a counter to the BBC in certain ways, but, you know, the BBC does its job very well. If you want kind of more right-wing opinion, there's plenty of newspapers which will give it to you, and indeed plenty of other sort of podcasts. And so I still feel that it's struggling in a gap which I'm not sure really exists. And you're right. I do know, you know, what it's like launching these new things, and everyone thinks the week sort of magically appeared and suddenly it was very successful. But it was a lot of hard work and a lot of time to get there. It took 6 or 7 years to really make it through and make a proper profit. And, you know, and that's way back in the days before social media. And so it's tough. And I don't know, I wouldn't rate its chances of being a big success myself.
Jake, obviously it's going to face its own competition with Talk TV. What Talk TV gossip have you got? Surely you must have some.
My life wouldn't be worth living if I was divulging Talk TV gossip on this podcast. I'm so sorry, Matt, but I do take a slightly different view to John. I have to say, I think actually now that the Andrew Neil debacle is behind GB News, and it was a debacle, it was a complete disaster, I actually think the station is quietly growing in confidence, and I think the Eamon Holmes signing is actually testament to that, because I think they have a clearer idea of their audience and the best way to serve that audience now. And I really think that Eamon Holmes probably fits in quite well. He has an appetite for the kind of contrarian commentary that has become a hallmark of GB News. And he showed it, you know, slightly alarmingly during the pandemic when he refused to dismiss conspiracy theories about COVID-19 and its links to 5G technology. Now, I'm not saying that GB News is... It sets out its stall to further conspiracy theories, but what they do is challenge the kind of mainstream agenda or the kind of mainstream views on certain issues, and that's what they set out to do, and that, I think they are achieving that in many ways. They also have had success with Nigel Farage's show. Nigel's getting close to 100,000 viewers. Nearly, you know, week in, week out. He managed to secure an interview with Donald Trump, which made headlines, you know, across the country, across most major media outlets, and generated the station's highest rating since its launch night. It is still getting zero viewers occasionally, but it is challenging Sky and BBC News on some nights. And
is it though? I mean, every bar,
it is.
Every weekly bar figure has been lower than the previous week. The Trump episode got 180,000, which was an amazing get for him. Great, you know, great interview for Farage. But like, if that's what they can get with, you know, the person that's of a real interest to their audience, is that still quite limited for them?
Well, that show beat Sky News and BBC News. And for a channel that is, you know, a few months old, I would say that's reasonably good work. I'm sure they would have been absolutely delighted about that. Do I think that GB News is going to be a huge challenger to those brands? No. But do I think that it has an established audience and the ability to take what is being broadcast on television and beaming out online and generate millions and millions of views across YouTube and other social networks? Yes, it's clearly there is a formula there that is working. And I think Talk TV, speaking to potentially for some of my bosses here, they've seen what GB News is doing. This is what I'm told, not necessarily internally by sources, but sources in the industry. They've seen what GB News is doing. They've seen that there's a gap in the market, and they are you know, looking to mine similar territory.
Well, I'm sure we'll return to GB News News in a later edition of the podcast. It's the gift that keeps on giving. And that brings us to the media quiz, which this week is entitled The Blame Thrower. I'll give you a media story from the week, and you've got to tell me who was blamed, whether rightly or wrongly. It's three rounds. You buzz in with your name if you know the answer. So, Jake, you will say...
Jake.
John, you will say...
John.
And Suchandrika will say...
Hey, Suchandrika, yeah.
And let's play the blame thrower. Number one, here we go, eyes down. Boris Johnson is still reeling from the scoop surrounding the Christmas party at 10 Downing Street last year, but who did he blame?
Jake.
BBC.
Jake, oh, sorry, who did John. He blame?
Well, even if I didn't know the answer, I do now.
He blamed you two.
No, well, sources close to Boris Johnson blame the BBC. I don't think we can go quite as far as saying Boris Johnson himself did. I mean, maybe he did behind closed doors, but... yeah, this was the Mail on Sunday splash this weekend, where it said that that Boris Johnson is furious with the BBC for a story that was first broken in the Daily Mirror and then furthered in furthered by ITV News.
Yes, you're right. Because obviously, firstly, mainly reported by ITV's in the Mirror. I'm not quite sure why the BBC gets the blame, other than it's a useful punching bag for the Mail on Sunday. Number two. Staying on the Mail. The Daily Mail was incensed by the BBC's raw documentary The Princes and the Press, particularly that the widely trailed revelations didn't come to pass. So whose fault was that?
Jake.
Oh, and again, Jake, yes. Whose
is
fault
the
was
answer
it?
Just the BBC to all of these questions?
Well, so this is the Daily Mail was incensed by the BBC's documentary. Whose fault was it? You're saying the BBC...
Or is it Meghan Markle?
Well, it's usually Meghan Markle. But also, I think actually whose fault it was the Daily Mail, who had widely trailed how controversial the show was going to be, according to Palace sources. So they were somewhat annoyed with themselves. Okay, number three, eyes down. The Sun's coverage of Partygate was rather muted. Who did Private Eye blame for that?
John.
Suchandrika. You went first, John.
The Sun, because the Sun was having a party at the same time. And it was a bit difficult for them to make a big fuss about Downing Street having a party when the Sun was having its own party on, I think, the same night. So, understandably, their coverage was a bit muted.
Yes, that's right. It was alleged by the Eye that the staff of the Sun had a Christmas party around the same time. Suchandrika, you're connected to the print world, the tabloid world. Any gossip around Christmas parties?
Well, I mean, for this Christmas party with the Sun, there are some people saying that maybe Rupert Murdoch was in town for his jab provided by the NHS. Thanks, Rupert. Thank us later. And that maybe he went... to this party newly jabbed. I hope his arm didn't hurt and that he had a great time, if he went, allegedly.
I mean, all of these things, it is slightly delicate for everybody, isn't it, when they're talking about Christmas parties and reporting on it. And, you know, Jake, there was some thought that on some of the government number 10 parties there might have been the odd journalist there as well.
There has been speculation about that, though I haven't seen. Are there names? If there are names, I've missed them.
I think they've tried to keep themselves to themselves. Yeah. But having Boris's journalist mates up to the flat at number 10 has been mooted.
Though these are different events, though, aren't they? We're not talking about the same Christmas party that has been the focus of the Mirror and the ITV News reporting. Is that right?
Correct. That's right.
Although I do think that. He held meetings with a number of senior editors around that time. So I think he saw, for example, Tim Davie, the Director General of the BBC, and Fran Unsworth, who's the Director of News at the BBC, around that time. Although these would have been, I mean, it's clear from the logs, from the Downing Street logs, that these would have been business meetings and, you know, probably rightly entirely separate from any festivities.
I'm sure there was no cheese and wine available for any BBC staff at number 10.
Of course not.
Winners this week, I think that's probably a draw between John and Jake. Congratulations. You can come to the winners' party when we're allowed. That's our show for today. My thanks to Jake Cantor, Suchanjika Chakrabarty and John Connor. If you've enjoyed this episode, why not bung us the price of a chocolate fountain for that party that you probably were going to have but haven't? To donate, head to themediapodcast.com/donate. And of course, follow us to hear new episodes when they drop on your podcast app of choice, or pop into a browser and type podfollow.com/themediapodcast. My name is Matt Deegan. You can find my weekly newsletter about the audio industry and more at mattdeegan.com. The producer of this episode was Matt Hill. It was a Rethink Audio and PPM production. We will see you again in 2022. Goodbye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.